but from slowness, a slow speed connection to the rest of commerce and the rest of the world. And that is why I started One Web Day. My name is Susan Crawford, and I wanted to see an environmental movement for the web. I wanted to see an Earth Day for the web, focused on some key internet concepts, things like making sure that communications traveling from one part of the world get to the other part of the world without being interfered with. The idea that the internet is about many-to-many conversations, not broadcast, making sure that everybody understands that, was important too. And keeping relatively low surveillance levels on the internet is also crucial so that we can all communicate freely. It's not about the technology. That's not why we have One Web Day. That's not why we needed an Earth Day for the internet. It's because of what the internet does to change human lives. That's the point here. That's why we needed an environmental movement for this tremendous transformation that have some guy in New Zealand I've never met asking me what on earth I have unleashed. You are One Web Day. I'm not. It's all the people all around the world that are volunteering to hold events outside in public places like this one. It's this year's theme, online participation in democracy, encouraging the city of Melbourne, Australia, to use a wiki to plan its city's future, to get contributions from all kinds of people, and then announcing the results on One Web Day. That's great. It's the city of San Francisco using One Web Day as a chance to extend wireless access to lower-income communities. That's fabulous. And today, in Rio de Janeiro, One Web Day is an entire full-page article in the largest newspaper, because Brazil is really leaping in to the idea of what the internet can do for their citizens. In the United States, where I'm standing right now, there are a lot of people interested in better internet policy, and my goal is to make those people visible to each other. That's what this is about. We make progress when we can see what's happening. So today we're here in Washington Square to be visible to one another, and I'm grateful for all the webcasters and all the people taking pictures and all the things that will be posted for everybody all over the world to see. All of this, all of what you're seeing right now, was done by volunteers around the world. And yet we're covering Tunisia and Bulgaria and Copenhagen and Finland. There are all these wild things happening for One Web Day. I want all of you to imagine what we could do with resources. What we could do if you opened your wallets and helped One Web Day become a resource for the world for increasing connectivity in all of the world's nations. So that's a plea I'm making up here today. Please contribute to One Web Day. We're making it as easy as possible. Then the world will continue to say, what on earth have you unleashed? This is about the power and heart of a visible community making its presence known. And we're unleashing all of that. Two more things, then I'll get off the stage. I want to say thank you to the volunteers with enormous heart and enormous energy here in New York who have made this event possible. In particular, Matt Cooperreiter, Evan Korth, Jolly McPhee, I mean, I love these people, Carly Tasso, Renee Edelman, Allison Fine, Matthew Burton, and a special thanks to Lawrence Corrett, right there in the orange hat, who is producing this entire event. Please hire him, Starlight Media. One more thing from our friend in New Zealand. Listen to what he said. There's a certain synchronicity of interests, of passions, a certain, dare I use cheese-eating phrases, a rare joie de vivre, even in depths of crisis-ridden times. Crisis equals opportunity. Grab it with both hands. This is a bad time for our economy, and one thing we can do to grab ourselves out of this time is to use technology, use internet access. Another function of One Web Day is to make sure we don't lose focus on that. But really, now I am going to get off the stage because One Web Day is about you, not me. We've got an amazing roster of people who want to talk to you about online participation in democracy. And to facilitate all that, I'm delighted to bring to the stage Sri Srinivasan, who is the Dean of Student Affairs at Columbia Journalism School and a very well-regarded tech reporter on WNBC-TV. Sri.
Susan Crawford, ladies and gentlemen. Come on, give her a big hand. She really has unleashed something very important and very special, and she's going to be back tomorrow morning teaching class at the University of Michigan Law School. She does this all on her own, and just because she wanted to change the world. So again, Susan Crawford, ladies and gentlemen. My job today is to be your traffic cop. We have so many people who wanted to participate and speak to you today that they brought me in to kind of help navigate this stream of folks who are here. We're going to make this a conversation. We have some terrific all-stars who are here and soon to be stars, and we want everyone to get a chance to talk and listen. We're going to do a series of short presentations, less than 5 minutes, they've promised me, from several people. After they're done, we're going to have a panel here. What we've done is there are two poster boards with a cell phone number onto which you can SMS or text your question for anybody who is speaking here today, or if you have a statement or anything you like. So please write down this phone number or put that right into your cell phone, and please text a question as we get going here. But let's get right to this. It's such an important and fun afternoon we have ahead of us, so let's get to it. I'm going to see if the Honorable Gail Brewer is here yet. If she isn't, we're going to get to our first speaker. Our first speaker is Andrew Barron, who is with Rocket Boom. Rocket Boom is presented in the format of a newscast with a comedic slant. Each weekday, Rocket Boom offers oddities, vlog excerpts, and explores emerging social movements. Please welcome Andrew Barron. Andrew, by the way, is shooting this also, so he's got the camera running by himself out there, and he's going to be speaking. Andrew Barron.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Susan. So I just am going to be really, really quick. I just want to just give you just a tiny little story personal to my life about why I'm here and why this is so important to me. When I was very young, I was really into music, and I aspired to be a musician, and I lived in Austin, Texas, and I eventually started to play in bands. And then actually for South by Southwest, the big convention, our band got noticed by the major record labels. And we got flown out here to New York by three different record labels, in fact, during this one time. And they all said the same thing in different words. They all said, I'm sorry, but, you know, after really looking into it, your music's just not commercially viable enough for us. It's good. It's just not going to ever work in this system. And it really hit me hard, and I had to kind of, I sort of felt like that was my dream, or that was sort of like my only opportunity. And this was actually at a time about a year or two before Napster. And so then as Napster came along, you know, as we all know, that really represented sort of like the democratization of music in a way. It had to do with just the situation in the internet. And unfortunately, I kind of missed that phase. I was already kind of going on to the next things and sort of giving up my dream slightly. And then I stumbled upon a video project that would have gone through the same situation. It would just been, you know, could I have gotten my video distributed on this small little environment? And luckily, I had learned my lessons from the music situation and knew exactly what was happening, that we were going through the democratization of media in terms of the motion picture. And I took that and I ran with it. And it's turned into a great business for me. And now I realize that how important, I kind of knew instantly how important it would be, but beyond just my own personal business, the video, music, all of this media that we're all putting out there, it's the most important thing that we're able to publish freely like this. And to imagine this getting taken away from us, to having the IP say no, that you can't do this or you have to pay extra, and getting and sort of moving away from this new democratization of media, it would just be it would be horrible. So I'm dedicating my life, basically, this is my life work, to making sure that that this continues to be open and free. And my final point here is that obviously extracting this into other sections of the world, this is the best opportunity for anybody in a smaller, underdeveloped country, anywhere in the world, to take hold of the tools and to catch up really quick. and to just jump right in and be involved. And that's possibly the most important thing in the world, is just to level the playing field for people around the world. So now that our economy is completely crashed out, I was inspired by Tim O'Reilly's last week when he said, stop building these iPhone beer apps and super pokes. Go out there and really do something. Let's really just go out there and do something valuable. So thanks again to Susan, and happy One Web Day.
I know there'll be people unhappy with your putting down those beer apps on the iPhone, but anyway, our next presenter is someone who many of you know and whose service you use every day, or every week at least. Please welcome the founder and customer service rep of Craigslist, Craig Newmark.
Folks, thanks. And just to clarify, I'm only one customer service rep at Craigslist. I report to the boss of the manager of customer service at Craigslist. On the way here earlier this morning, I had the moderately stunning realization that my job, well, another term for it, is community organizer. Because that's probably the one of the purest expressions of actual grassroots democracy, and that's one of the things that the net is about. The net is more or less a level playing field. That's the intent. That's something we're fighting for, which is an allusion to the whole net neutrality issue. But the deal is that the net really does give power to us all. It really can make a difference, and we're seeing people using the net right now to mark the transition from top-down big money politics to grassroots, bottoms-up, genuine grassroots democracy. And maybe that's the biggest thing happening right now in our lives. The idea is that everyone here can, and you choose the politics of your choice, but you can get online and work whatever your belief is. You can actually do something and work with other people and actually have maybe a small amount of power, but a lot of power working together. I do note, for example, that right around the square, there's at least two voter registration efforts. And for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to register yet, feel free. I will mention that there will be very shortly a really, really big voter registration effort based on the net. That will help out a lot of people here, because I suspect a lot of problems college students might have is not knowing where to register and then getting an absentee ballot if you need. So please, if I've ever helped you out through the site, get register to vote and then do something about it. Beyond that, again, a lot of things are happening all around here. You're in an exciting area where a lot of net things are happening. The future of journalism is happening right around here. There's ProPublica, there's Huffington Post, Media Bistro, there's great work being done at NYU, people on the I Want Media program, Clay Shirky, Jay Rosen, and even a little north, there's Jeff Jarvis at City University. You're living in the middle of stuff which I think is much bigger than anyone knows, but it all has to do with the democratization of the country, because we have a real struggle now. It has to do with the democratization of media. And in this world, everyone gets to play. And, you know, that ain't bad. Thanks, folks.
Thank you, Craig. You should know that we asked both the campaigns, the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign, if they would participate in One Web Day, and you can see more information about what they might be doing and how they'll be participating on the website. Our next speaker is Dharma Daly, and she has more than 15 years of experience working to open up the public airwaves. She's the director of research for the Ethos Group. Please welcome Dharma Daly.
Okay. I go around the country, and I do participatory action research on how community networks are being used. And I found that the analog PowerPoint is future-proof. Where are my handlers here who are going to help me with this?
Okay, great.
Hang tight for a second.
Okay.
So when Susan gave the topic as democracy participation in the web, I was like, oh, God. Three catfish to nail to one tree in 5 minutes. It was not... I just don't know how to get my mind around concepts that big. Is democracy something that I can participate in with my pocketbook? If I agree with a click wrap to a terms of service, does that mean that I'm an equal participant with Comcast and Google and AT&T? When I give consent, to what do I give consent? Am I online if my library has one connection and one computer, no matter how old, whether it's available to me during my work hours only, as the Bush administration has defined access? Is participation simply access to goods and services? If there's tiered services, does that mean we have tiered participation? Is there a difference between being a netizen and an e-consumer? Participation in what? For me, participation means meaningful, timely participation with people of my choice, information that I choose. And that begs the question, what kind of interference between government and business should we tolerate? What kind of bottlenecks are acceptable? That's the choice that netizens here, we have to decide here on the streets today. The big questions are questions that are really challenging to answer. What policies, what technologies, what business models, and what subsidies enhance and widen the circle of participation? And how do we get beyond the hyperbole of what works and what doesn't? What are the yardsticks that we measure our success with? I know that we're all here today because we're very excited about the web and its possibilities, but as somebody that's worked in community radio for a really long time and knows community radio policy really well, I get really scared about the possibilities of a web in the future. We had something that was very web-centric starting in about the 1860s when tinkerers and players and amateurs and citizens like you and I started playing around with the airwaves trying to communicate. And that worked from the 1860s until about 1920s when in a very, very short period of time, just a couple of years, a couple of business interests, a couple of manufacturers, and their friends in government passed through something called the Communications Act of 1934. And that was the beginning of the broadcast model, okay? And the broadcast model is based on this. Big antennas, one voice to the many. And the fact was is that we forget this. There's a historical fiction around this that's based on the idea that there's a technical fiction. The technical fiction is... We know that small web-centric communication worked because it worked for decades before 1934. And in a very short time, the broadcast model formed. And that's where we are with the web today. I want to show you this. I was doing this workshop, by the way, in a barn in upstate New York, literally, yesterday. This, what do you call this? Nobody. It's a trick question. You're right. It's a cell phone. We call it a cell phone. This is a two-way radio and a computer, okay? And when you take a web-centric concept like this, many-to-many, and you apply it to the technologies that we have today, look at this. One phone call in the 1940s out in the field, your general or whatever, with a cell phone like this. Today, the same amount of bandwidth over the airwaves makes 100,000 simultaneous phone calls. That's what the cell is in cellular, okay? And there's orders of magnitude more possibility if we just take all of the tricks that already exist. This is not science fiction, okay? This is reality. We can do this now with the science. It's the historical fiction and the economic fiction around these technologies that keep us from being able to use these airwaves for our own benefit. Thank you. Oh, I need to make a plug. Next week, City Council is going to be having a hearing on how the public airwaves in New York City is going to be used. So feel free, folks, I don't know who has these flyers out there, but consider coming out to the hearing. Okay, thanks.
Folks, we're already getting some excellent questions on the cell phone. So please text your questions. The phone number is right there. One of the questions I got, what can I do to help protect internet freedom? These are just some of the answers we'll get to you and get you to after we do the panel, when we do the panel discussion after these quick presentations. Our next speaker is the Honorable Gail Brewer. She is the chair of technology of the Technology and Government Committee in the New York City Council, and she has been an advocate of using wireless, broadband, and other initiatives to open up technology here in New York City. Please welcome the Honorable Gail Brewer.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on Web Day. You know, this morning at City Hall, you've had such an impact that all the seniors from all the senior centers came to City Hall to celebrate Web Day also. So I want to congratulate you, because what's exciting about this day, thanks to your involvement and initiation, is that everyone feels that they are part of it. And the seniors in this city are one of the fastest growing users of technology. And now we as government have to help them be the persons who can actually utilize it, because obviously, it's thanks to Tom Camber and Oates, which is one of the organizations that is helping seniors get online. But if it wasn't for Oates and some of your support, they wouldn't be able to, because a lot of the senior centers have staff capacity, but they don't have participants and members capacity. So that's just one example of the great work that Web Day is doing, because now the seniors are part of it. I want to just piggyback on what the wonderful previous speaker stated to tell you that in the City Council, in the Committee on Technology, we're trying from different ways to address the digital divide. That's an overused word, but currently we've had, thanks to a bill that passed in 2005, we have a mayoral commission. You're always welcome to come to the City Council website if you don't know about it, or if you want to make sure you get regular advisements on it. That commission has got mayor's appointments, council's appointments. We've been meeting in all five boroughs, and we have been now part of a discussion, because there's no question that if you're a family, you're living in New York City, you can afford the rent, you can afford whatever school supplies young people need, you can afford getting to work. But there is a time at which one item has to go, and that is often the connectivity to your internet site. That happens over and over again with a lot of families. The libraries are not open enough. The schools are only open during school days, and we don't have enough places for people to go to have broadband or any other kinds of access. Park access is great in Washington Square Park. It is not great in all parts of the five boroughs. So one aspect of what we're doing is trying to find ways that, even though we may not have municipal Wi-Fi everywhere in the city for the public, although I would like that, the fact of the matter is, what's the next step? And we really want to hear from you on that topic. Number two, as you know, on September 29th, at 10 a.m. at City Hall, we are having a hearing on white spaces. And believe me, most people, except in this office, have no idea what we're talking about. So first, we have to educate people that this is incredibly important to our future. It's important as to who get access, making sure that it's for the public. And I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. We also have in New York City a discussion about Broadway and the shows and what they need. So it's quite controversial, quite interesting, and very important for you to weigh in. I also just want to talk for a minute about the issue of the schools. To me, we have, as you know, 1.2 million students, thousands upon thousands of teachers and about 1,400 buildings. The way the E-rate works from Washington is the classrooms are wired, but the hallways, the lunchrooms, the gym, the open spaces are not. And in 2008, the entire building should be wired and should be accessible not only to the schools and the students, but if I had my way, public spaces could be perhaps opportunities for the public to use that space. So we need to think completely differently about how we get access. We have a lot of public places in which people can go to be to use computers or to use access. If we can't have it municipal-wide, the public spaces should be activated. So I'm here to say thank you for your support, because I can tell you we are a small band in terms of the larger public that understands what the steps are in order to be accessible and to get rid of this divide. The public housing is another area where we're trying to be more influential. In the Bronx, there's a group that is a company that's working with NYCHA to try to make sure that many more individuals in public housing have access not only to technology but also to security. Because if you can provide access and security to that building at the same time, you've accomplished two very important goals. And finally, I see Tom Loewenfop here from Queens, who's been working on a really wonderful domain name so that we could all be proud and economically secure for a lot of small businesses with .nyc, because it's going on around the world, and New York City needs to catch up on this and so many other issues. So thank you very much. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, everybody who put this day together. You're wonderful. Thank you.
We have some great questions coming in about net neutrality, opening up the radio spectrum, et cetera. Please text your questions to this number, and we'll have a panel very shortly with some of our speakers. Our next speaker is S.J. Klein. He's the Director of Community Development for the One Laptop Per Child Project. He's a veteran Wikipedian and has been was the organizer of last year's International Wikimedia Conference. Please welcome S.J. Klein.
Gosh, not last year. For those of you who came down to Boston in 2006, that was an awesome conference. But last year we had it in the Library of Alexandria, and that was really a reminder of how things have changed. OneWeb Day for me is a really joyful event, and it's great to see it year by year growing in its international scope. But I feel a little pessimistic today. I feel impelled to pass on the fact that over time things change. I mean, over the thousands of years since the Library of Alexandria was first founded, Alexandria has been reduced to much less than the international city that it once was. And the library that they recreated 6 years ago is still just a shadow of what it hopefully will be again and what it was for so long. But even in the most sheltered of places, these kinds of institutions, very much like our web, they fade. And OneWeb Day is about wishes as much as anything. And my wish is that as we think about the amazing things about the web and what we hope for in our reasonably ideal and stable world, we should think about how we can preserve what matters most for times that are not so stable and for generations that don't have the luxuries that we do. This isn't just about the developed versus the developing world. This is about our time, which is really a time of openness with almost no barriers to communication and to sharing, in contrast to times when we can already foresee those kinds of barriers will come down. As Dharma was saying, participation is not consumption. And the web is very much about participation. When it comes to the web and democracy, the spirit of a web of connected people is a very old and fundamental spirit. It's not related to the internet or technology. It's related to how we as a global society work together and share ideas together and come to understandings. And some people have dark visions. Professor Zittrain likes to write about the future of the internet and things we should do to stop it. But even that's talking about the future within the system, not about the future when systems fall. So we should focus, in my world, on education and on voice. If people are educated and they know how to build things, they can recreate a web from whatever they have at hand. if they have a voice, if they know what it means to have a voice and to be a disciplined participant in civic society, then they can recreate that society, even when they have to do it with a community of 10 or the community of 100. That is a valuable web. Education is something that the web is not very good at yet. It's very good at communicating, at a bit of narcissism, even at fact-checking, but at social transactions, not so much. And what we currently call social sites, they are more about consumption than about doing anything significant. How many people here have read legislation or have read civic policy on the web in the last month, say? And how many of you have ever taken part in a civic referendum on the web? That's pretty good. I'm impressed. But so many people have not. And these are things that have not become part of our culture, even as the web has. So in our celebration of One Web Day, we should celebrate education, and we should celebrate the capacity to learn and to teach and to pass education on to others. We know there have always been dark ages, and one thing we should do is define the tools that are needed to preserve the skills and to preserve the social interactions that we currently admire and benefit from outside of the web, in our social society, in our normal political discourse, and to pass those on and disseminate them as widely as possible to every culture. Currently, we have, despite all of the rumblings in this city, political, economic, environmental stability. But only once we've made a clear statement about what tools we wish to preserve and what interactions matter to a properly functioning civic society, and somehow pass those on to cultures everywhere, can we say that we have really preserved the spirit of this one web that we share for our grandchildren. Thank you.
I just wanted to give out the phone number in case anyone's watching live and wants to send a question in. 347-738-0748. We have three more speakers, and then we go to an in-depth panel discussion. Our next speaker is Professor Jonathan Zittrain. He's a professor of internet law at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and he's the author most recently of The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Jonathan Zittrain.
Thanks so much. It's so nice to see you here in real space. I like this so-called real space and this city. This is great. I'm pleased to be here. A guy named Tim, who's a physicist, trying to kind of avoid getting his real work done, invents something wonderfully branded as the World Wide Web. And by invent it, we mean he comes up with a way to communicate that he just shares with the world and says, if you want to talk this way, it might be cool. And the more people who talk this way to each other using these protocols, the bigger the web will be. He wasn't the only one. Some of you here may remember Gopher or WISE or FTP. Can't imagine why the web beat those out. There are lots of bad ideas, lots of good ideas. The internet on which Tim Berners-Lee built the web is open to everything. And that's why I actually celebrate the iPhone beer application. While I hate being bitten by vampires on Facebook as much as I do being super poked, I celebrate that it's there because God knows out of that crap, something good will emerge. So in some ways, I see One Web Day as a celebration of the fertile crap which gives rise to the next generation of growth, of green, of trees, and not worrying beforehand which is which. I remember when I first heard about Twitter. Somebody said to me, it's kind of like blogs, only more inane. I was like, that's what the world has been waiting for. What will come next, right? Just one letter status updates. And that might be good too. The fact is, you don't know ahead of time. And as there is now a Facebook group celebrating the fail whale, the icon on Twitter when something goes wrong that's the Twitter birds trying to lift a whale out of the water, you can join a fan club for it. We see that it takes on a significance that you would never have expected. A guy named James Carl Buck was a Twitterer who went to Cairo, interested in some unrest that was happening there. He gave a tweet heard round the world, followed by 572 people. The single word, arrested. That was enough to start the links going to the State Department, the Foreign Ministry, the police, and to actually get him sprung from jail. So if somebody named Craig wants to start a list and just see where it goes with a user interface that has not been updated since 1994 and a half, more power to him. If a guy named Jimbo wants to start a free encyclopedia that anyone can edit at any time with seven articles as the seed, that's the stupidest idea in the world, and it's great. It's Wikipedia. And that's why if somebody named Susan wants to start one web day and see what happens, here we are virtually and literally together to celebrate. Now, I confess, I share a little bit of S.J. Klein's pessimism. If we were attuned to the web innately, it would be sometimes as if a great disturbance had happened in the force, and millions of voices and computers cried out as if one and then were silenced. Every moment, another computer is pwned. Probably among the people here, either pwners or pwnees, I don't know which, or both. This is an insecurity that means we will be promised a set of technologies that tell us they'll clear out the crap. They'll just give us the ringtones we've been craving. They'll give us the applications we know we love, all in one convenient package. I want us to resist that, and the resistance takes many forms, but largely it means we need to take some ownership of this collective hallucination we call the web. If you're an artist and you're typically doing creative stuff, try coding a little bit. If you're a nerd whose only English words strung together tend to be the emanations of an anonymous coward on Slashdot, try writing a blog about something political. In fact, if you're a political candidate running for president, try learning something about the internet or even using it. In 1996, John Perry Barlow, who's here today, wrote a Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. "You weary giants of flesh and steel," he says, "I come from the land of cyberspace with a message, leave us alone." The problem is that cyberspace has now annexed the real world, and the question is, what do we want to do with it? I say it is a challenge to us to make not just cyberspace now, but the real world a world better, one in which we want to live, one that has these values of welcoming contribution from all corners, and not being too quick to say what works and what doesn't, what's the crap and what's the gem. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is the aforementioned John Perry Barlow. He is a legendary cyber libertarian, a poet, essayist, and retired Wyoming cattle rancher, and a founding member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and, of course, former lyricist of the Grateful Dead. Please welcome John Perry Barlow.
Boy, it's really nice to be in meat space on a day like this. This is a beautiful day in New York. Thank you. I'm going to be very brief. We have a lot of speakers. There's a lot I could say. The reference that was just made to the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, I've spent many years since then having people take that thing and present it as a good example of the silly things we used to think in 1996. Now, I'm not going to defend the prose style. I was imitating Jefferson, and he was a better writer. But I will defend the idea that we are still in a condition on the internet and on the World Wide Web where the default is open expression. The default is being able to say whatever you want to say. And that's true all over the world. And we've had to fight a lot of institutions and governments to keep that true. We've all had to collectively make sure that the architecture that underlay cyberspace was sufficiently open in its design that it would be very difficult for the politics to become closed. I think we've been astonishingly successful in all of this, and I want to thank you along with everybody else that's participated, because it has been a collective human endeavor. Finally, I want to say, you know, there are a lot of people who also feel like, well, you know, and now it's no different from the physical world in the sense that it has all the ugly features of life among the humans. And then some I hadn't really thought about before, but they emerged there. But, you know, I still believe that we are very much at the beginning of this. When we called it the Electronic Frontier Foundation as opposed to the Electronic Freedom Foundation, we knew that there was going to be a serious dispute between all of those institutions and humans and groups that had power during the industrial period, and all those groups that were going to arise in digital media and seek that power through openness of information. And that fight goes on continuously. I mean, we had to... EFF is very proud of the fact that it took the United States Congress to pass a bill to make it so that we couldn't sue AT&T for what had obviously been illegal. And by declaring that it hadn't been illegal retroactively, it's a very interesting legal precedent. But now we are having to sue the United States government, the president, the vice president, the NSA. And I actually think that we'll win. But we are going to need your help. If you want to do something for digital liberty, at least be aware of the issues that we're confronting. Go to www.eff.org and take a look around. Because I think the real thing that counts, the most important thing, is that we have it in our grasp to be the kinds of ancestors that could give our descendants the right to know. Not just the right to speak, not just the right to listen, but the right to know anything that might be generally relevant to them, no matter where they are, no matter how much money they have, no matter anything. And we can do this. We can give them that gift, and I really hope all of you will participate in that. Thanks.
I forgot to read my favorite title of John's from his card. It says Peripheral Visionary, which is a great title to have. We have two more speakers and then the panel discussion, and we've got lots of great questions coming in via the cell phone and SMS. The phone number is there. Please remember to send in your questions, and we're going to set up the chairs in a couple of minutes. One of the fascinating things about the internet is how words change meaning. There was a time when I was growing up when surfing meant going on the water, then surfing meant channel surfing, and now surfing means, obviously, the web. Same thing with a word like Pandora. Once it had something to do with something from the antiquities, and now it means the Music Genome Project. Please welcome the founder of Pandora.com, Tim Westergren.
Okay, my favorite line so far is this fertile ground for crap. I'm going to keep that one, absolutely. So I just want to tell a little story about our experience with democracy as a business, which I think is pretty profound and is maybe a sign of what's in front of us. So Pandora operates under what's called a compulsory or statutory license, which means that there's a piece of federal legislation that guarantees us the right to play all the music that we have in our collection by signing one license, one piece of paper, called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And the beauty of that license is that with one signing, we can play literally tens of thousands of the music of tens of thousands of artists. We actually have over 60,000 in the collection right now. And it's great because it allows us to play stuff from, you know, garage bands around the country. We don't have to go and get their direct permission to do it. As part of this federal statute, though, every 5 years, the rate that we pay for that, the songs that we stream, is subject to... Can you hear me okay still? But do I need to speak louder, or... I'm okay? Okay. Every 5 years, that license is subject to an arbitration by a panel of judges in a copyright office in Washington. And about a year and a half ago, that group met, three judges, and decided to massively increase the royalty that we pay as a business, so internet radio. And after some sort of frantic calls to all the folks that we knew might be able to help us, it looked like we were done because our appeal was denied. There was no sort of seeming recourse from the rights holders. And so we were kind of getting ready to fold up the tent and decided, well, let's try one last thing and actually ask our listeners to help us. And Pandora, along with a whole host of webcasters, sent emails to their listeners and said, please take a second to call your local representative in Congress and email them, call them, send them a fax, and ask them to please intervene and prevent this sort of catastrophic change from hitting. And the response was unbelievable. In a matter of 3 days, there were 400,000 faxes sent to Washington. The entire fax infrastructure on Capitol Hill was shut down for almost a week. And eventually over 2 million people actually called in on this issue. And the result of that is that Congress actually intervened and called the parties together into Washington and said, look, something has obviously gone terribly wrong here. We'd like to use our fax machines again. You guys need to sort this out. And if you don't, we're going to. And as a consequence of that, we at Pandora and the webcasters have now been negotiating with rights holders to come up with a much more equitable, reasonable solution that will allow us to exist and that will preserve the statutory system. And I'm sort of hopeful that we can get there. And I think that is an astounding occurrence. I mean, can you imagine 10 years ago that there would have been a sort of arcane change to a piece of legislation in Washington and an industry that's full of very powerful lobbyists, and that the general population would actually be able to get up and say, no, not this time, and actually express their voices strongly enough that things would be changed. And, well, lo and behold, it seems to be happening. And I think that, you know, to me, the most sort of significant, effect of the internet with regards to media is the fact that you can really participate and make a difference. And the "you can make a difference" is such an old, tired phrase. And it's been used, falsely for so long. But I think that's actually changing. And we've experienced that firsthand. And I hope that we're going to experience that, you know, across media more generally. So I encourage you to participate because I think you really can make a difference. I can speak from firsthand experience about that. And if you did make a call for us, thank you. And we hope to survive and continue offering this far more diverse, personalized listening experience on the web. Thanks for coming out today.
Our final speaker before our panel is Lawrence Lessig. Lawrence is a visionary whose influence on cyberculture and how journalists, intellectuals, and others think about the internet is very hard to overestimate. He is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and founder of the School Center for Internet and Society. Please welcome Lawrence Lessig.
So I'm honored to be here to celebrate this OneWeb Day, as it is altogether fitting that this day, like the Earth, should be celebrated in this way. There is an endless list of technologies that 40 years ago, only science fiction writers or professors at MIT could have imagined. But on that list, there's only one that we could imagine celebrating with a day. There will not be an iPod day, Steve's dreams notwithstanding, nor will there be a one PC day, whether or not Seinfeld agrees to come. Only this technology, the web, Only this community, the web, only this dream, the web, makes sense to celebrate in this way. And of course, there is much to be proud of. This technology, this community, this dream is far more than any of its founders ever could have imagined. As Holmes said of the Constitution, that it, quote, called into life a being the development of which could not have been foreseen completely by the most gifted of its begetters, so too could we say of the net. And indeed, that is precisely what we cheerleaders have been saying of the net as we have fought to defend it from the changes that would corrupt its most precious feature, that it repeatedly surprises even the most gifted of its begetters. Defend it, that is, by keeping it open to change, free from the inevitable design of those who have made it, to make it so that the platform on which they made it doesn't encourage others to displace them. But as I reflect upon where we are today, and by we, I mean we Americans, just one part of this world, I grow increasingly impatient with celebrations. I grow tired of self-confident pride. We are in the middle of a war, paralyzed by terror. In this city, the financial system of our nation is collapsing across our nation. The financial system of millions of families has already collapsed. And yet at the center of this mess is a government, the product of a democracy which too few of us respect. A president favorably thought of by less than a third of the nation, a Congress favorably thought of by less than 10% of the nation. The only branch in our government enjoying majority support is the one branch not elected by the people, the court. We should pause to think about just what this means. There were more who supported the British crown at the Revolution than support the U.S. Congress today. And I suspect more who had faith in our government attending to the problems that were ours at every point in America's history, save that one point that quickly slid into a civil war. We must change this. It's time we turn this extraordinary platform for hope, the web, to more of the extraordinary public problems that weigh us down. It is time we use the inspiration and power of this technology, this community, this dream to fix what is broken in this real world. It is time the virtual gets used to fix the real. Our crisis in governance has perhaps never been as profound, and it feels almost Hollywood-esque, maybe Harry Potter-esque, that just at the moment when things are as dark as they possibly could be, we get handed this magical tool that could, if used well, save this day. But the fact is, things are this dark, and we have been given this tool, and we must use it to learn again how citizens govern. There is a government we are responsible for. There are enormous problems it has either caused or it is not curing. Let us take this technology, this community, this dream, and use it to restore democratic responsibility and community and a dream. Thank you very much.
Folks, please get your questions ready. We're going to have the panel discussion right now. And you can send in your questions via text message. And I know Larry has to leave soon, but he's going to stay for a few minutes, and we'll just see how this goes. Kind of Web 2.0-y approach to panels here. Thank you. Thank you for the water. Yes. Please come on up, folks. Please give them a hand. Let's see, who else is? Dharma, are you coming up? And SJ, okay. We'll just remind everyone of our speakers, Larry Lessig, John Perry Barlow, Dharma Daly is standing there, SJ in the red, Tim Westergren from Pandora, and Jonathan Zittrain from Harvard. Please give them a hand, folks. And I see we have Andrew Barron also coming up from Rocket Boom. As I said, he's filming this event at the same time, so very meta here. All right. We've gotten several good questions, but since Larry has to leave, maybe we'll start with you. If you could, Professor Lessig, tell us what you're working on now and how that ties into everything that you've just told us about.
So after spending a decade working on the problems of free culture and the way that Congress is convinced that freedom means restriction as much as possible, I thought that we needed to begin to focus on the core cause to the craziness in policy and about copyright and global warming and every other issue, which is the extraordinary and destructive influence of money on our political system. So I shifted my work just last year to begin to work on a project we've named Change Congress, to focus on this institution, which was for our framers the most important democratic institution, which is for us now the least relevant, most despised institution in our government. Because until we can fix this, my view is, until we can fix the way it addresses our problems, none of these problems, from global warming to the healthcare system, to the financial disaster, to copyright, will be addressed properly.
So what can people do to get involved?
So go to change-congress.org, and there's a place you can sign up and volunteer to do an extraordinary range of things, from research to web work to helping us pester members of Congress into taking a stand on these issues.
Excellent. Thank you. SJ, I believe you talked about the civic referendum on the web. Is that correct? You're the one who made a reference to that? Here's someone asking, what are you talking about?
Civic referenda and the kind of direct democracy that lets communities say, here's what we really need, and here's exactly what I'd like you to, as legislators, to act on, is something that the web makes possible in ways that had extraordinary frictional costs before. But this is a part of government that has been very slow to adopt to the tools that the web provides. So I don't know of any good referendum systems with communities that develop their own referenda online. But that's the sort of core power that the web has, which we should all be taking advantage of.
Okay, thank you. A reminder, the phone number to text a question is 347-738-0478. And we also have a question here about net neutrality and its role in this year's electoral process. Larry, can we get you started on that and maybe go down to hear what people are thinking about net neutrality? It's a topic we hear about, but we don't necessarily all understand what's at stake here.
Right. So network neutrality is a set of principles about preserving the architecture of the Internet the way it was originally designed. And what is that architecture? It is the design that says people at the edge can invent whatever content, whatever applications they want, and the network owners have no power, either technical power or legal power, to block applications they don't like. This is the way the web was. It was how the web flourished. It's what created the extraordinary innovation that we saw on the web. But as the web has become the hot new opportunity for economic wealth, the owners of the platform, the pipes, or the tubes, as they're called in Washington, want to leverage their control to be able to get as much money out of this as they can for their own benefit, regardless of the harm it will have on the rest of the net. So we need to defend it. And what we need to recognize is there are literally hundreds of millions of dollars spent in lobbying on this issue in Washington every year. Hundreds of millions of dollars. And we can't begin to match that through money.
So we've got to match it through organization if we're going to preserve this architecture that created this net.
Someone already thought of it. They said the lobbyists are the core of the problem, Larry. Is there a law defending their right to exist? Can they be outlawed?
No, I would defend their right to exist. Okay. I would defend their right to participate in this debate. I would defend their right just as I defend a lawyer's right to stand up before the Supreme Court and argue his case or her case. But I don't think the lawyer has the right to say, we can build you a swimming pool, Supreme Court. We can fund your retirement, or we can give you a new car if you'd like, the way a lobbyist effectively gets to say to members of Congress when they try to persuade members of Congress. So there's a role for free speech, lobbyists included, but there isn't a role, in my view, for using the power of money to distract them, to make them dependent upon this money as they try to do their work.
Thank you. John?
You know, the problem with net neutrality is that everybody talks about it. You know, it's like they used to say about the weather. You know, is everybody talks about it, but nobody does anything about it. The reason that more has not been done is because, however much we might agree that an open network passing back and forth packets that are identical and dumb, as they say, how important that may be, the means are really subject to, I think, legitimate and hard debate. For me, I think competition is what we need more than anything else. But, you know, as the councilman reminded us here this morning, in this city, it is almost always the case that the last 500 vertical feet do not have competition. And so if Comcast or Time Warner or any one of a number of major carriers decides to stop carrying all the alt groups or to collude on prices, or do any number of things that we don't believe are appropriate, they can go ahead and do so because there's no countervailing competition to stop them. So one of the things I think really needs to be done is right here at the local level and support those initiatives to deregulate, or to regulate just enough to keep those carriers from strangling the internet at the local level.
Andrew, do you have a thought about this topic? So just talk into it. I'm sure they'll... Go ahead,
check,
just talk.
Check one.
Maybe you can borrow John's microphone.
Well, this is very important to the matter that I was speaking about with regards to having open access. A perfect example would be collaborations with the main tubes and more legislation that allows essentially big business to control those waves. So then they could say, you're not allowed to put your video because it's a video, or you're not allowed to take your audio and stick it on this channel, and then you would not get a preference. And then that would be, again, returning back to an old system where there's more of a, it feels more like a gatekeeper scenario. And there's always ways to penetrate it if you're clever, but it's more about the whole and having everybody be able to participate. And I think that somebody said it earlier, you know, as soon as you start to add tiers and start to add other people's, as soon as you start to add businesses' motivations in there, then suddenly you end up with people on different tiers and different opportunities, and that's just completely wrong. So,
Dharma Deli from Ethos Group.
Well, what impresses me, looking back historically to the Founding Fathers, is that not only did they come up with the First Amendment, but they also created the first open access network called the U.S. Postal Service, which was the state-of-the-art network of its day. And it was completely publicly subsidized, and it was a long-term investment, the kind of investment that we would hope that our future governments would consider. It was a long-term investment both in democracy and in economic development, which said that we need to make sure that wherever everyone, everywhere, is able to completely participate in this process of democracy by having a communication on this open platform. And they not only did that, but they did something that seems just like a radical terrorist idea right now, which is they separated and they created a firewall in the USPS between spying, government spying, and this free flow of information that they were creating. And I think, like, in some ways that the whole era of mass communications, I wish we could just, like, turn back the clock and start over again with the internet, because we have all of these precedents, not just in the lobbying, but deeply, deeply ingrained into the FCC. Like, it's like fractals. At the large, you know, looking out at the large level, you kind of have this push towards the hub and spoke, push towards monopolization, down to the nitty-gritty details. And the only way that I see that we're going to be able to do it is what John said, which is competition. And I think that, for me, the competition has to be that somehow we need to keep working with the old dinosaurs. They're not going to die on us. We need to work with them. But we need to have a critical mass of different kinds of ownership that will create different kinds of constraints in the market overall. So I'm thinking about public ownership of the backbone, or something that is accountable to the public in a different way. And then there's also at the grassroots level, ownerless networks. So maybe that last 500 feet, maybe every person owns their own last 500 feet. And so we have, you know, three different layers of ownership happening within the overall context of what we're trying to achieve.
Thank you. S.J. Klein from One Laptop Per Child.
I think Dharma said some of that really well. Teach people how to build their own last 500 feet and find ways to make the backbones publicly owned. I think if you have to negotiate with people to convince them that neutrality is a good thing, then you're already talking about the wrong kind of solution.
I'm going to pass on to John.
Good.
I want to see another rabbit pulled out of a hat from somewhere, kind of a Harry Potter, like, everything's great. Everybody gets a car. Everybody gets a car kind of thing. For Oprah watchers among you, thank you, Fred. Open spectrum, where there's some bandwidth that's unallocated to a single monopoly person who won an auction or had it assigned to him or her, has been an amazing boon, right? Some guys at the IEEE were like, all right, you know, they're not great on naming. Like, let's call it 802.11b. Like, yes, that's what it's called. So it's like they should have called it like Little Debbie Snack Cakes, but it didn't matter because open Wi-Fi is pretty amazing. There is more to be invented there, so that I agree with competition, but there was a time when competition was AOL versus Prodigy versus MCI mail. It's like, whom would you like to pay roughly $7 an hour for, and would you like a mix of CB Simulator and sports or some weather too? And the web came out of nowhere and kind of trumped it all. So I'd like to see maybe even a little bit of government subsidy. You could add it to the $700 billion rescue package with, like, just a rounding error to fund some of these people at MIT who, like, will work for food, and have others see if there are ways to get ad hoc networking going so that on the island of Manhattan, a piece of data can hop from one PDA to the next, and at no point are you on the backbone. Or you can do microwave towers, all sorts of other things. We're just getting started. And once the path is shown, then you'll get the dot-coms to come in and give it a good name and sell it, which I don't begrudge them. So I want to keep that innovation part of it going, too.
One quick note, though. If you have a Wi-Fi router in your possession, you can open up the net right now by taking the security gateway off of your router and putting it on your computer where it belongs.
How many of you do that? How many of you keep your networks open, your routers open?
Communists.
Dharma, here's a question for you. How can individuals advocate for opening radio spectrum and counteract the corporate interest in locking up the public's right to use its own airwaves? Just need a mic here. Okay.
There are thousands of ways that you can participate, all of which I'd like to tell you now, but I can't. There, you know, that's really a question that's specific to the agency of an individual. I mean, one thing that groups like NYC Wireless here in the city are doing, Il Son Fil in Montreal, there's actually dozens and dozens of groups around the world that are innovating on the technology in this really amazing kind of way that is very participatory and very on the ground, working with communities to both innovate on the technologies that are being used in just with what's available right now in the airwaves, which is very constrained. But there's still a lot of possibilities when you put locality together with people who have really specific communication needs and desires and a couple of technologists. So one thing is to start your own network. Join the, if you have some technology ability, join the people who are participating in creating those technologies. If you happen to be a policy hacker, you can join the Open Air Coalition or some of these groups that are trying to push for more spectrum and more access, more direct access by the public, for the public, of the public airwaves. That's another great way to do it, because Wi-Fi is the most amazing thing. But remember, it came in through the back door sideways. It came in as this sneaky little technology that wanted to, you know, it was meant to, the FCC thought they were giving away something that would keep people from tripping over printer wires. And we've tried, you know, and this has been hacked and hacked and hacked by thousands of people around the world to try to, you know, wireless Ghana, okay, unwire, like, whole countries and stuff like that. So there's a lot more that we can do if we have more opportunity to innovate, and that requires some policy changes, too.
Okay, Larry, I know you have to leave. Would you give us your thoughts on this? And also, I'm going to ask everybody on the panel, what is something new and interesting you've seen in the last few weeks that you'd want to share with people?
I can't share that. That's really private. Well, I think that one thing that's new and interesting is how irrelevant technology policy has become to this presidential debate. We haven't framed this issue as one of the critical issues about how we're going to get over the next 10 years, and instead have allowed it to fall way down on the list. Now, I don't care whether you're for McCain or for Obama. I have a sense of where you are, and I don't think it's really as important that the president actually know how to wire up a website. But I do think it's critically important that people recognize that if we turn digital future over to those who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to buy it, lobby for it, to buy the right to control it, from the spectrum auctions that have been architected in a way to guarantee that just one or two companies are going to own the most important beachfront spectrum for the next 25 years, to network policies that will allow the owners of the wires to actually control what the future looks like. Until we get this debate above number 20 or number 25 in public awareness, we're never going to make progress here. And that's exactly what people here can do. One Web Day is a mechanism for doing that, but it's something that all the people who are doing extraordinary things to make this alive in communities have got to community organize a bit to get it out of communities into the center of the debate that makes the decision that we have in November turn on this critical issue among 10 others.
I know Larry has to leave, so Larry Lessig, ladies and gentlemen, change-congress.org. Okay, thanks. I'm curious, if you'd raise your hand, if you work on an online business that you founded some way, or you're one of the first people to work at your company, raise your hand. Look at that. I mean, so there's a chance for you to connect and interact with some people, so we hope you'll do that. Here's a question that's come in that says, what exactly is the current web policy that is so outdated that everybody keeps talking about? Who wants to tackle that? What is the current web policy that is so outdated? John, you look like you have something to say on that.
I don't think that's the problem. It's mostly policies that really were designed before there was a web, before there was an internet, that are trying to be applied to the internet and the web. I mean, old systems of owning ideas, and I think that is, you know, you cannot own an idea. You can perhaps have a temporary license on its the monopoly of its expression, but now we have laws that claim to own, give people the right to own ideas, and I think that is pernicious, and it has to go away.
Okay, Professor Zittrain.
I'm at risk of dating myself here. I don't know how many people remember the old program, The People's Court, on television.
It's still on the air, but it's still on the air, by
right.
the way.
Yeah. Oh, Judge Walker,
the new People's
kind of
Court. Yeah.
It wasn't clear why they called it The People's Court, because like the people didn't do anything; they were just like in the audience, right? But at the end, Doug Llewellyn would stand before you and very gravely say, "If you have a problem with someone, don't take the law into your own hands. You take them to court." And when I think of the problem, it's an ethos that we have that says that if we've got a serious problem, there'd better be a law that prevents it and some recourse that we can ask for of somebody whose job it is to make it better. Now, I'm not against law, so let me just make that completely clear. I
From
like
Harvard
law.
Law School, right?
Yes. There are times when that's exactly what you do. But too often, we decide it's somebody else's problem to fix the problem. And one of the most amazing things about the growth of the web has been the ways in which new communities, new enterprises, knowing that there isn't a clear law one way or the other. Remember when people used to ask you for permission to link to your site? It's like, what do you say? Like, yes? Give me a jelly bean? Like, you know, it's a free country. Just link to the goddamn site, you know? And that was not clear. It is still not clear, in my view, under copyright law, whether it is okay to surf the web. But, like, we're just going to let it slide for now. So I'm eager to see us continue to develop ways that as problems come up, very real problems, we come up with a happy medium between it's all libertarian, just grab your gun and defend yourself, metaphorically, electronically speaking. If somebody's libeling you, you need to go online everywhere where they're saying the lies and counteract it with your own view. That doesn't cut it. But also not trying to make a federal case out of everything. And I do think there are tools and mechanisms we can use peer-to-peer so that a critical mass of people of good faith can actually help maintain order. The way that order in this park is maintained, not because there are riot police standing by at Astor Place to come over if anything should go south.
Are you sure?
Well, I wasn't in on the arrangements, but generally because we are a place at peace and people of goodwill. And 90% of the time, that gets the job done. 10%, we have to deal with that. But the other 90 is what we also have to shore up.
Tim from Pandora, I know you wanted to weigh in on this, but also we got a question. It says here, I love Pandora. What are the chances that it will disappear?
Okay. So before I answer that question, just a general thought, I guess, for me about the sort of evolution of media on the web. Before Pandora, I was a musician and spent many years trying to make a living at it. And so I have some familiarity with how hard it is to do art for your career. And I think one of the great challenges that this open web causes for us is that everybody expects everything for free now, which it's cool. It's nice that there is that kind of sense of free exchange of things. But I think that the public is going to have to start to sign up for an exchange with people who create art and recognize that you may not be willing to pay for it, but you need to pay for it in kind somehow. And I think we have to be careful as a consuming public of having some kind of knee-jerk reaction to the idea of monetization and marketing and advertising and so on. And Pandora falls right in the middle of that because we deliver a free service. In order to do that, we have to put advertising on it. And I think that, you know, not just in music but in all forms of art and content, I think as listeners, as consumers of it, we have to take responsibility for supporting it because if you don't, I do think you're going to sort of undermine an industry because artists aren't going to be able to make a living at it. So just food for thought, you know, how can we as consumers be a constructive part of the equation and not just the one saying, I want it for free, I want it for free.
Do you think Tipjar could work? Could Tipjar work?
I think there are a lot of experiments with Tipjar out there right now. There are many. Slice the Pie, you know, there are bunch of websites that are trying to, you know, Radiohead and all that, all these phenomena we all know about, to be determined, you know. The second question you had was whether the chances will disappear. Let's say I'm sort of cautiously optimistic that the negotiations will work out. But again, thanks to the public, because the folks negotiating around the table know that if they don't fix it, there are now 16 million Pandora listeners that are going to go on the fax machine. So it's all good.
Okay, speaking of another big project, we have S.J. Klein here from One Laptop Per Child. Can you update us on the project and how it's going and what people can do to participate?
Sure. To answer your previous question about exciting things from the last few weeks, we started getting 20,000 children connecting to our website from Uruguay through their laptops a couple weeks back as they did one more push for the school rollouts. And it's so great to see a new group of internet newbies going through all the stages of joining the web.
What banner ads do you show them?
Only animated GIFs.
What banner ads do you show them was what he asked.
I mean, watching them discover how much fun it can be to be a troll and then to post someone else's assignments for them, and that's really awesome. So I guess the quick rundown is OLPC has given laptops to a little over 200,000 children in Uruguay and Peru, and there are about three times that many that are in delivery or somewhere in the stages of getting to children. And the vast majority of them are English and Spanish speaking at the moment, but there are active projects in Haiti and Mongolia and Rwanda and Ethiopia that are all sponsored from the giving program last Christmas, which is pretty remarkable because those countries didn't have the funds to start a product on their own.
So what can people do, and how does it work, and what's the plan for this giving season?
So I think the two things that people can do is they can join our wiki and they can start contributing to the conversations there. Some of these children and teachers are now having conversations about how they should be carrying out their classes there. If you're interested in education, you can visit wiki.laptop.org and take a look at the recent Spanish editions in particular. And people can go to laptopgiving.org as well, and they can donate in advance of the holiday season. But there will be another giving program this holiday season where people can get a laptop and donate a laptop as well.
So what is the model this year? What is the pricing going to be? Do you have that yet? Or
I think you can find all the details already at laptopgiving.org. It's very much like it was last year. And it's the only difference is that we're picking a different set of countries.
Excellent. I want to make a couple of introductions of people who are in the audience that you should know. I see Andrew Reisich. Andrew, just want to point him out. Andrew is the founder of the Personal Democracy Forum and someone who's really involved in a lot of issues here in New York about some of the things we talked about. So if you get a chance, please say hello to him. And other people, if you want to text me, I will introduce you. But Michael Smolens is here. He's got a very interesting project. It's called .sub, and the idea is .sub.com. He wants to do subtitling on all languages of all video that's possible. Where's Michael? Are you here? Michael's project is very interesting, so that if we have this video, for example, it's all in English, it could be translated into other languages. Is that right, Michael? That's an example of that. If you go to twitter.com, you see the What is Twitter video. That's now available in 41 languages, which is pretty cool. So if you have something else you want me to announce from here, I will. We're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes. We're still taking more questions. But let me go to John. What's something new you've seen that's interesting and that people should know about?
Well, I think I want to italicize what Larry said. I don't know if anybody will be able to hear me. But I really believe that, you know, as in 1960, media suddenly and surprisingly made a difference in who became the president of the United States because of the Nixon and Kennedy debates. And I think that this year the internet is going to make that difference and already has made an enormous difference in the sense that one of our candidates has been able to raise a huge amount of money in small donations, which finally gives us back the real rights of democracy. And not until we can get people who think about something besides making an enormous nut for their next campaign by cozying up to every fat cat that has an address in Washington that starts with national or American, we're not going to have democracy, and we don't at the moment.
Anything new and cool you're looking at apart from this?
No, I think it's new and cool that we have reached the point where I think the internet is going to be a huge factor in determining the outcome of this election. And, you know, it is so completely the case that I don't think I even see people talking about it, in spite of the fact that I think that it is very new and very cool.
Okay. Andrew from Rocket Boom, same question.
Check. I actually just wanted to follow up on the election process. I'm a little bit pessimistic and I'm concerned. I was heavily involved online in the 2004 election and felt the same sort of uprising and the micro donations and everybody pulling in. We all remember the Dean scream, kind of the culminating moment from the last election. And after the election was over, it turned out that the Democrats who had lost kind of attributed their loss basically to not really getting their message out to the people that were in the small towns in America that weren't quite yet connected. And that I kept thinking, after having lost that last election due to not being having all of that spirit and energy that I put online, it didn't add up to finally winning it, I felt like. And I'm concerned again this year that despite the increase in all of the internet activity, just as anticipated, that still yet there's too many people actually in small towns in America that are not connected. And they're not getting their news from the New York Times. They're not getting their news from anywhere except for word of mouth through other people maybe in their town that are also not connected. And I'm just really concerned about it. And I hope, I really do hope that this is the year that the internet will decide the election. If not, for sure, the next term will.
Well, can I just push back on that? If there are so many people who are disconnected, right here in New York, we have a digital divide. Is it right that the internet should determine who will be president?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question, but I just do believe that what's missing is that those people in the small towns that are not connected are not getting good information, and that they're not able to basically come to the right conclusion for themselves.
That rolls into exactly what I'm excited about, because I've been going around the country. What I call participatory action research is another, also known as couch surfing, going to places and communities that don't have good access and are trying to solve their own problems and put it in their own hands. Check out the projects, Burlington, Vermont, Lafayette, Louisiana. These are places that are brave places where the local leadership is taking the communication systems into their own hands to do their build-outs. And I'm telling you that if you've heard about those places, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands more that are trying to do it under the radar without getting the wrath of the lobbyists and the big telcos on their side. And I'm very excited about it because it really, when you get to the grassroots level and you see the kinds of the ways that people are really trying to make things happen, it's not Republican and Democrat anymore. It doesn't break down like that.
Okay. Yeah. SJ, what are you seeing that's new and exciting? I know you already gave me a little bit, but maybe something new in some new service or something you've seen?
I think the most exciting collaborations I've seen online in recent weeks have been very short-term political action collaborations. I think just because in this country so many people are enthusiastic about what may end up to be completely trivial political events, they're able to bring together crowds and to launch social events in 12 or 24 hours in ways that certainly weren't possible the last presidential election.
Thank you. Tim?
I keep my eye on the music space mostly, and the things that are exciting me there is a generation of companies who are doing sort of offering music and allowing listeners to sort of voluntarily set a price. There are sites like Slice the Pie, Celeband, Amy Street, and they're getting traction. That's really exciting to me, and I think that we're going to start seeing the growth of a musician's middle class, which to me would be a tremendous... I think, social and cultural boon for the country, among other things.
Here's a question that came up. Does your advertising strategy in any way determine what I hear on Pandora?
No, completely unrelated.
Okay. Just also an announcement that Tim is going to be speaking at NYU Wednesday at 3:30. See Evan Korth for details. Evan is working with Tim, so see him for details. Okay, Jonathan. What are you thinking?
Well, first, I'm a big fan of Pandora. Like, you tell it three songs you like, and then it's like, here's a bunch of stuff that sounds just like that you hadn't heard of. You're like, shit, I am so predictable. and it's not through a collaborative filter. It's not like people as dorky as you also liked this. I think you, like, have interns in windowless rooms that you call music experts who are like, that has a syncopated rhythm, right? It's really cool. Amazing. So, I didn't mean to suggest it's a sweatshop, though. So, anyway, I tend to be a little behind the curve. I don't see the good stuff until it's pretty damn obvious. Like, I think there might be something to the Wikipedia. Like, I'm getting pretty excited about it. But I am intrigued by a lot of the new efforts that are at the intersection of community and .org and money and .com. There might be Yelpers among us who like are really into Yelp, but also feel a little oogie because there's Yelp.com that's making money off their exploited backs. And I'm really interested in how those dynamics work and ways in which they can work together well. And finally, the discovery of today of One Web Day. I just got to say, Susan, you've really started such an incredible thing, and I'm just so pleased to be a part of it, and I think all of us are very, very excited.
Actually, as Susan said before, there are a lot of ways you can participate, and you can go to One Web Day, but please, since you're here, see her and see how you can help next year. It's always going to be on September 22nd, and at 6 months after Earth Day, and that's how she's thinking about this. So please help her out and help everybody out. And I'm going to leave the last word to our resident poet here, John Perry Barlow.
This will be pretty prosaic. I just want to respond to your pessimism, which I, you know, some hours of the night I share. But I want to say, I want to remind everybody of something that Tip O'Neill said, who was a very local kind of politician and very responsive in a democratic way. He said all politics are local. And the reason that the Dean campaign did not prevail was because there was an internet constituency and there were local organizers, and it was kind of like a funny donut where the hole was a big circle around the center. Now you've got to be able to get that connection made between the people who are online and the people who are down there going door to door. And I think that's happening now, but it has to happen a lot more than it is.
Okay, a couple of quick announcements. Wikis Take Manhattan, Wikipedia and Streets Wiki Picture Scavenger Hunt across New York City. It's taking place this Saturday, I believe. The address is, where you can look it up, is at wikis-take.org. Wikis, plural, -take.org. Who sent this? Anybody here? Okay, talk to him about that. And finally, I want to make a plug for the Knight News Challenge. Some of you know about this. The Knight Foundation is giving away $5 million for projects that are local and tie the internet and information or news together. And this is something that a lot of people here have ideas about. One of our former students at Columbia got $340,000 to do this project called Spot.us. I know someone else who got $600,000. The website everyblock.com, Adrian Hallavati, got $2 million. The deadline is November 1st. And you can go to newschallenge.org. Any individual, nonprofit, for-profit, anybody can do this as long as it's local, physical community, and ties the internet and news together. That's newschallenge.org. Susan, do you have something to add? Or thank you. All right. Let's thank our fabulous panel, folks. And they're going to stick around for a few minutes so you can come up and say hello. And good luck, everybody, and enjoy One Web Day. Goodbye.